It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of our ancestors, all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. I just want to add to what Sahar just said about the website. I want to encourage you to go to the section on practice and under that, the section on questions and answers. They're really helpful. There are really good questions, and it can just quickly bring you back into the mind of Buddhism, spending even 5 minutes dipping into those. And I've made them in sets so that you never have to worry about repeating. You just, I already know I did set one, so I'll just go right to set two. Anyway, I think they're a really useful way of spending time that you don't know what else to do with. Okay, that's all of that. So today I want to tell you about what the Dalai Lama says about ignorance. Actually, ignorance and then action, the second link. And it fleshes out the general description that I gave last week. So I think you'll leave today with a pretty good understanding of ignorance and action and how they work together. So he begins, this is the Dalai Lama then, he begins with how the Rice Seedling Sutra, which is the sutra in which the Buddha explained the 12 links. So as most sutras do, it begins with questions from the Great Assembly. And so someone asks the Buddha, from what do these karmas that are the sources of suffering arise? In other words, what is the root cause of our suffering? So what is the root cause of our suffering? And the Buddha answers, the afflictive emotions, we talked about afflictive emotions, pride, anger, jealousy, etc. The afflictive emotions of desire, hatred, and ignorance. And you've heard this expression, greed, hate, and delusion. It's the same thing. Desire and greed is greed. Hatred and anger are the same. And ignorance and delusion. So if desire, hatred, and ignorance doesn't land with you, just think of greed, hate, and delusion when I say that. So the afflictive emotions of desire, hatred, and ignorance, which give rise to virtuous and non-virtuous actions, which in turn give rise to one of the six births in cyclic existence. That's the gods, demigods, humans, animals, hungry ghosts, and hell beings. So he's saying desire, which is greed, hatred, which is anger, and ignorance make us act in either a virtuous or non-virtuous way, which lands us in one of those six realms. For the time, try to suspend your disbelief and just picture this. So you can easily dismiss things later, but just so that you get a sense of the rhythm of the cyclic rhythm. So there's these afflictive emotions, that's critical, and ignorance is one of them, that lead to our actions that are either good or bad, let's just say, which lead to our for future lifetimes, it's that are either going to be pleasant or not pleasant on the whole. Okay, so that's that. Then someone else asks, so what's ignorance? And the Buddha answers, of the many interpretations of what ignorance is, one is the mere non-knowing of how things actually exist, a mere this is mere obscuration. Buddhists love to use that word, obscuration. So obscure, it's darkness, you don't know anything. So there's a non-knowing, that's one way of thinking of ignorance. But the 12 links, ignorance in the 12 links is explained as the wrong consciousness that conceives the opposite of how things actually exist. So it isn't just not knowing, but it's actually thinking incorrectly that we inherently exist independently as separate individual beings rather than interconnected. So ignorance is the chief of the afflictive emotions that we're seeking to abandon. And he furthermore makes the point that when we reflect on our own desire and hatred, you can think of greed and anger, we see that they are generated within a conception of oneself as very solid, due to which there arises a strong distinction between oneself and others, and consequently, attachment to oneself and hatred for others. Attitudes of desire and hatred are all based on an exaggerated sense of I. Are they not? The Dalai Lama asks. I'll repeat that. Attitudes of desire and hatred are all based on an exaggerated sense of I. Are they not? Says the Dalai Lama. So there is indeed a conventionally posited valid I. There is a valid I, a self that is the doer of actions, that is the accumulator of karma, and that is the person undergoing the pleasure and pain that are the fruit of those actions. However, when we examine the mode of apprehension of the mind, when the I becomes the troublemaker, we find that we are conceiving a self-instituting I that is an exaggeration beyond what actually exists. When this I appears to the mind, it does not appear to be designated in dependence on the aggregates of mind and body. Rather, it seems almost as if it is its own separate entity. If it were to exist in such a solid, independent way, then when one investigates it with a middle way reasoning, I don't know what exactly that is, but I'm sure it's very rational. If it's investigated that way, it should become clearer and clearer, but in fact, the opposite happens, such that it becomes less in the eye, becomes less and less clear until it cannot be found. If it were so concrete and independent, it would be findable under analysis. The fact that it cannot be found indicates that except for its mere designation, independence on the coming together of certain circumstances, it does not exist. Still, it appears to us, our minds, as something that can be indicated concretely, but when we assent to this false appearance, we get into trouble. This is what the Dalai Lama feels. The conflict between the concrete appearance of the eye and the fact that when analyzed, it can't be found, indicates a discrepancy between appearance and how things actually exist. And he says physicists make the same distinction between what appears and what actually exists. Physicists are also studying that same whatever you want to call it, conflict or something. So then the Dalai Lama switches to the subject of desire. And this is a very interesting, I think. So here's how he breaks it down. He says, in our own experience, we can identify three levels of desire. The first is just noticing an object with impartiality. The next is when we see a certain thing, article, in a store, let's say, and we have a desire for it that constitutes an initial type of desire. So we see an object in a store and we have a desire for it. That's an initial type of desire. But after we buy it, we feel, this is mine. And that's the third level of desire. And the second and third are similar in both being attitudes of desire, but they differ in strength. So he says it's important to distinguish these three levels. And that the first is a mere appearance and recognition of an object. And it doesn't generate very much desire. You just notice something. And then we feel, that's really good. And desire has been generated. And this is the second level of appearance and he calls apprehension of an object, just knowing an object. And upon deciding to buy it and making it our own and cherishing it, that's a third level. On the first level, which consists of mere appearance, the object, so now he's going to get into the confluence, how desire and our belief that things inherently exist come together. What happens when those two things meet? So on the first level, which is mere appearance of the object does seem to exist independently. However, the mind is not strongly involved with the object. So then the second level, when desire comes in, it's induced, the desire, he says, is induced by ignorance that apprehends it as existing inherently. There is a subtle level of desire that can exist at the same time as this consciousness that conceives the object to exist inherently. So there is a level of desire and a consciousness that conceives of inherent existence. But when desire becomes stronger, the concept of inherent existence acts as its cause, the cause of the desire getting stronger, inducing still more desire. And then but does not exist at exactly the same time as the desire. I just find that really interesting. It is crucial that it is crucial to realize from your own experience that the following three things. On the first level, there is the appearance of an object as inherently existing, but we're not that involved in it. The second level is a consciousness that assents to this appearance, thus giving rise to desire on the third level, when we have bought such an inherently pleasing object and made it our own, the object becomes involved with a strong conception of ownership in which we consider it to be extremely valuable. At the end of this process, two very powerful streams of adherence, attachment for the inherently pleasing object and attachment for oneself, have come together, making the desire greater than before. And then the Dalai says, reflect on whether or not this is so, says the Dalai Lama. So reflect on whether this is, these three levels are so. The level one, you just see something. Level two, you go, oh, that's really beautiful. And then there's desire starts to begins to be made stronger by this sense that that object really does exist. And then in the third level, the desire, that sense of inherent existence is very strong, and it makes the desire very strong, and the two of them come together, and it's a very powerful experience. I think we've all probably experienced that. And the Dalai Lama says the same mechanism there is true of hatred. There's an initial experience involving a conventionally valid perception of the qualities of an object. For instance, seeing something bad and identifying it as bad. Then one produces hatred upon thinking, oh, this is really bad. That's the second level. And then when the hatred is related to oneself, it's stronger. And when it is seen as potentially harming oneself, it's even stronger. So that's the same exact mechanical building up of feelings involving our false belief of inherent existence of things and ourselves with desire. I think it's just a really interesting way of looking at our own consciousness and our own minds. And I'm going to ask you to do this too for the week, on the week's reflection. Let's see. Okay. This gets even more interesting, actually. Thus, the ignorance that is the conception of inherent existence acts to assist both desire and hatred. And in dependence on such ignorance, the second level of the 12 links of dependent arising action occurs. When the action has been done, this is what gets more interesting. When the action has been done by ascension being, us, it produces a predisposition in the mind. And this predisposition has the potential to continue unhindered until it produces its effect. So this is the cause consciousness that potentially continues until it produces the effect consciousness. And there can be a really long time in there. Actually, lifetimes can separate. So we can have the effect consciousness of a cause consciousness several lifetimes later. I'm just saying that. You don't have to buy that. But that's what the Tibetan Buddhists are saying. And it's just super interesting to me that we can get involved in something this lifetime, and it's actually the result of something three lifetimes ago. Okay, so now there's one more thing that's very interesting, I think. Also, taking a human lifetime as an example, there are actions that impel or project one's bodily life in a general way. And there are other types of actions that fill in the picture, so to speak, which are called completing actions. So there are generating actions and there are completing actions. These fill in the specific details. And this right here is all I'm going to say really about the details of karma, but this is so interesting. I wanted to share it with you. So there's the generating, projecting our bodily life, you know, that we are going to be born, let's say, as a human. And then the completing actions that fill in the detail, for instance, causing one's body to be beautiful or ugly and so forth. Consider a human who undergoes many illnesses. As a case of all other humans, the projecting or impelling karma was a virtuous action. Remember, it has to be involved in good ethics. If we're a human being, we did something ethical at some point. So it had to be a virtuous action. And that's, you know, that just because we're a human being. So you see a human being and you say, they did an ethical action in the past. But the completing actions that fill in the picture by creating a propensity for disease are non-virtuous actions. So we're talking about a human being who undergoes many illnesses. So we know that there was a virtuous action to make that person a human being, but they undergo many illnesses comes from unvirtuous actions, the completing actions. So, and the opposite occurs when the impelling karma is non-virtuous and the completing actions filling in the picture are virtuous, as in the case of an animal with a good, healthy body. There are also causes in which both the impelling and completing actions are virtuous, as well as the opposite, in which both are non-virtuous. So don't forget here. So then another question comes, how are karmas accumulated? And I want you to be sure to remember, this is all about cause and effect. Everything I'm saying goes back to cause and effect, because cause and effect is karma. That is, karma is cause and effect. So that's what karma means. So you hear people say, well, I don't believe in karma, you know, like it's this hocus pocus thing, too new agey for me. It's a complete misunderstanding of what karma is. I mean, karma is simply, you put a glass on the edge here and it's going to fall on the floor. There's a cause, you put it on the edge, and then in effect, it fell on the floor. That's all karma is. That's karma right there. Period. That it's cause and effect. So, and you see it as I asked you to do this exercise a few weeks ago, I think. Look at anything. Take any single thing and see it as an effect and ask, what's the cause for this? And you will always find an answer. So here we go. How are karmas accumulated? For example, one particular motivation may lead to certain physical and verbal actions. And a good motivation leads to nice words and gentle actions, whereby good karma is accumulated and an immediate result is felt in a creation of a peaceful and friendly environment. However, anger motivates rude words and harsh physical and verbal actions, immediately creating an unpleasant atmosphere. Okay, now listen to this. In both cases, an action is produced with ignorance of the final nature of phenomena as the background. This is the first stage of karma. That just means that our belief that things inherently exist. So that's not step one. When the action ceases, it imprints a potency, a predisposition into the consciousness, and the continuum of the consciousness carries this potency to the time of the fruition of that karma. So in this way, an action creates both an immediate result and a potential that eventually brings about either a pleasant or painful experience in the future. That's the part that it blows me away, that every single thing we do produces both a result right now and a potential. It establishes this predisposition in our head that to do the same thing. So that we've really got a lot against us if we do a misbehavior. There's already the result of that that's not too pleasant, and then there's the potential to do the whole thing all over again in our consciousness. I really didn't know that, and it explains a lot to me about my own behavior of why did I know something was wrong and I kept doing it, you know, something like that. There's this potential. It's almost like we're all addicts in a certain way. It's kind of like there's this seed to be an addictive personality in everyone. That's just me. So I don't know if that's true, but that's how it lands in me. A problem is that between the action and its fruition, there can be a considerable period of time. Yet all Buddhist systems assert that karmas are not lost or wasted. So there's never an action that doesn't have an effect. Never. All Buddhist systems, every single kind of Buddhism, and there's lots of kinds of Buddhism. You know, I'm a Soto Zen Buddhist. There's Rinzai Zen Buddhist, there are Vietnamese Zen Buddhists, there's Korean Zen Buddhists. There are many other Buddhists besides being Zen. There's a trillion kinds of Buddhism. And they all assert that karmas are never lost or wasted. So that's the, I don't care if you believe that. What the important thing is, be really careful about your behavior. That's really what is important in all of this to me, is watch out, because we can just do a lot of harm without even thinking that we're doing anything wrong. Just be careful. That's really all I'm saying here, but it's elaborate, because the Dalai Lama is a Tibetan Buddhist and this is how they study things. But it's also somewhat interesting, I think. Karmas are never lost. However, between the cause and the effect, something must connect that cause and effect. Let's say the cause was two lifetimes ago, let's just say, and I'm living it out now. So there are many different assertions within the Buddhist systems regarding what connects the long range effect. But the Dalai Lama says that the highest system, in his opinion, is a school called the consequence school. In Zen, we don't talk about this, but he does. He studied this. So, and the consequence school says what connects it, what holds together the continual basis of infusion of predispositions, is the mere I, the mere person, and that that's the continual basis, is this put forth I, and that the temporary basis for the infusion of predispositions is consciousness. So our consciousness holds it, and also our predisposition, our what we think of as an I, that also holds it. Moving on. In this way, immediately after an action, there's the state of cessation of that action, which, it could be said, turns into the entity of a predisposition infused in the consciousness. The consciousness extending from this moment until the moment just before the conception in a new lifetime is called the consciousness of the cause consciousness. The consciousness in the very next moment in which the connection to the next lifetime is made is called the effect consciousness. And then forget the lifetime thing. Just go, when there's a cause consciousness, then there's an effect consciousness. And in terms of its duration, the effect consciousness lasts from that moment so there's a cause consciousness, then there's an effect consciousness, and then this lasts to the time just before the fourth link, name and form. You don't have to get too into this. I'm going to explain it all later. But just to give you kind of a what happens then, it goes all the way to name and form. And name and form is just our aggregates, which means all the way till our next lifetime in this case, or just until we develop further in the as a embryo. And so he says, think of name and form. Form is the aggregate of the physical body. And he says, think of it like a boat. There's the boat, and then there are four people in it. And the four people are kind of our mental things. Consciousness and our mental actions altogether. The period of name and form continues during the development of the embryo until it develops the five sense organs, and then that's going to lead to more things. So don't worry about any of this. I just wanted to give you a sense of the motion of ignorance, and then an action coming right from that ignorance. And then the conscious leading to consciousness, first a cause consciousness and then an effect consciousness, And then there's the, then there's name and form. There's us, you know, we are developing now into this embryo. Then the Dalai Lama asks for questions, which are really interesting. Question one. So this is just a listener. Please give your definition of I, the self. And he says, the supreme of all Buddhist tenet and systems, the consequent school holds that just as a chariot is imputed independence upon its parts and cannot be found among the parts themselves, so a person is merely imputed independence upon the mental and physical aggregates, but cannot be found under analysis among any of those aggregates. So we've got a body, we've got all these mental things, but where's the I? That's what he's saying. A chariot, there's a, we call this thing a chariot, but really all we see are wheels and a carriage thing and, you know, spinning. But where's the chariot itself? Where is this thing chariot? So thus, not only is the I dependently imputed, but, okay, listen carefully. This blows his mind boggling. Not only is the I dependently imputed, but all phenomena are dependently imputed. Even emptiness is dependently imputed, as is Buddhahood. All appearing and occurring phenomena are just dependently designated. It's another way of saying it's everything is just emptiness, or nothing. When we sit down as Zazen, we're trying to be, if we're trying to do anything, it's just to become nothing. So that's what that says. All appearing and occurring phenomena are just dependently designated. Everything depends on everything else. And it's just, and starting with ignorance, which gives the permission to dependently designate an inherent existence of anything, including Buddhahood. Okay, that's that. Then another question. Since all appearances and all life are just illusion, is it not inconsistent to say that there are levels of appearance, such as those you mentioned earlier this morning? So those three levels of appearance, of desire, those three levels. If life is an illusion, how can you talk about three levels? And the Dalai Lama says, it's not that life is an illusion. Rather, it is like an illusion. Therefore, we can speak of many different types of discrepancy between the things, the way things appear and the way they actually exist. For instance, something that is actually impermanent can appear to be permanent. Sometimes things that are actually sources of pain appear to be sources of pleasure. There are types of conflict between the way things actually are and the way they appear. As regards final reality, objects appear to exist inherently, but actually lack inherent existence. This is another level of discrepancy between appearance and fact. So it's not that life is an illusion, rather it's like an illusion. Another question. How does belief or disbelief relate to ignorance? Answer. Mostly we have the belief that objects inherently exist. They appear to exist from their own side, and we believe that they exist this way. This type of belief is induced by ignorance. That's how he answers. How does belief or disbelief relate to ignorance? So this type of belief is induced by ignorance. Question, when is desire cause and when is desire effect? Answer, desire can serve as a cause of later moments of desire. And those later moments of desire are instances of desire that are effects of a previous cause. He's so logical. Okay. Net last and final question that's very important. If a predisposition toward an action has formed in one's mind, must one inevitably complete it, or is there a way out? So once you've done an action and then there's a result and a predisposition to do the same, to do it again, are we stuck with that? And the Dalai Lama says, if you were able to bring about a condition that is more powerful than the condition that would cause the karma to manifest, it can be overwhelmed. For instance, through disclosing ill deeds, developing contrition, and engaging in virtuous activity aimed at purifying a bad karma, you can purify it. At minimum, you can diminish its force such that even if you meet with a condition that would have caused it to become activated, it will not. So the Dalai Lama is really saying that yes, we can. Yes, we can. If we've done something that's already set a predisposition in our mind to repeat it, can we stop it? And the answer is yes. If we confess that we've done something that wasn't so good and we're contrite about it, we're not go, oh, but it doesn't matter, who cares? That's not what we should do. We should go, yes, I understand, I did this thing. And then there are actions that will purify our behavior. When I was a Tibetan Buddhist, in order to get permission from my teacher to have like personal one-on-one training given to me, I had to complete what was called the Nundro, which was 400,000 repetitions of four different practices. And it took me 3.5 years. However, it was extremely purifying. And I feel so grateful, honestly. I could just feel karma peeling away. I really could. Anyway, in America now, a lot of Tibetan Buddhist teachers don't ask for that anymore. You hardly ever even hear the word today. People don't know what I'm talking about if I say to someone who is a Tibetan Buddhist, oh, did you do the Nundro? What's that? Go figure. I don't know. My teacher wouldn't do a thing until you finished it. All right, I want to rush on because I've talked a long time. There are 8 main points. I'm sorry, but there'll only be 2 reflection questions. First, the conflict between the concrete appearance of I and the fact that when analyzed it can't be found indicates a discrepancy between appearance and how it actually exists. And physicists make a similar distinction between what appears and what actually exists. So for us to just know that. Second, the Dalai Lama says that in our own experience, we can identify 3 types or levels of desire. The first is just noticing an object impartially. The next is we see an object and have a desire for it. And then after we buy it, this is mine. This is the third level. And the second and third are both attitudes of desire, but they differ in strength. So we should just understand this about, this is how desire works. Third, regarding desire, the Dalai Lama also says that on the first level, which consists of the mere appearance, the object does seem to exist inherently. However, the mind is not strongly involved. On the second level, desire for the object is induced by ignorance that apprehends that it exists inherently. And there is a subtle level of desire that can exist at the same time. So on the second level, there's desire and the belief of inherent existence, the coexist. And when the desire becomes stronger, the conception of inherent existence that acts as its cause and inducing still more desire, but it does not exist at the same time. So our belief in inherent existence on the third level of desire, they don't coexist at the same time. And I find that very interesting. And I really want to look at myself and catch myself when those two do not coexist. Fourth, the last line of the sentence that I just made, when desire becomes stronger and the conception of inherent existence acts as its cause, inducing still more desire, but does not exist at the same time. I'd like you to find that in yourselves also. I think it's a separate, those two words, it's included in the third point. The fourth point is included in the third point, but to think of it as a separate thing also. Okay, fifth, taking a human lifetime as an example, there are actions that impel or project one's bodily life in a general way, and there are other types of actions that fill in the picture, which are called completing actions. These fill in the specific details, for instance, causing one's body to be beautiful and ugly and so forth. So this idea, this is how karma works. There's an impelling action and there are completing actions. Sixth, in both cases, the action is produced with ignorance of the final nature of phenomena as the background. That's the first stage of karma. When the action ceases, it imprints a potency or a predisposition into the consciousness, and the continuum of the consciousness carries this potency to the time of fruition of that karma. And all Buddhist systems agree that karmas are never lost. So that's extra. In this way, an action creates both an immediate result and the potential that eventually brings about either a pleasant or painful experience in the future. That's point six. Point seven, the supreme of all Buddhist tenet systems, the consequence school, holds that just as a chariot is imputed independence on its parts and cannot be found among the parts, so a person is merely imputed independence on the mental and physical aggregates, but cannot be found under analysis among any of those aggregates. Thus, not only is the I dependently imputed, but all phenomena are dependently imputed. Even emptiness is dependently imputed, as is Buddhahood. All appearing and occurring phenomena are just dependently designated. And last point, if you were able to bring about a condition that is more powerful than the condition that would cause the karma to manifest, it can be overwhelmed. For instance, through disclosing ill deeds, developing contrition, and engaging in virtuous activity aimed at purifying bad karma, you can purify it. At minimum, you can diminish its force such that even if you meet with a condition that would have caused it to become activated, it will not. And finally, the two main ideas for your reflection this week. There's only two because I hope that you'll really do these. And the first is the Dalai Lama's assignment. Regarding desire, the following assignment given to us by the Dalai Lama is worth repeating until all parts are very clear in your mind, probably 5 to 10 times. So the assignment is, it is crucial to realize from your own experience that on the first level, there's the appearance of the object, as inherently existing. Okay, I look at my statue here of the Prajnapati, Buddha's stepmother. I look at that object and I believe that it inherently exists. I really do, actually. On the second level, there's a consciousness that assents to this. Yes, I do believe that. Thus giving rise to desire. And I really want to have that on my desk. So I look at it all the time. And then on the third level, we have bought such an inherently pleasing object and made it our own. And the object becomes involved with a strong conception of ownership in which we consider it to be extremely valuable. I always can't remember her name, Prajna. I'll tell you her name another time. Okay. At the end of this process, two very powerful streams of adherence, attachment for the inherently pleasing object and attachment for oneself, have come together, making the desire even greater than before. Reflect on whether or not this is so, the Dalai Lama asks. That's his assignment. And I've sort of just given you an example of one of my favorite statues. Okay, second assignment. The Dalai Lama gave the following description of how karma works. An action is produced with ignorance of the final nature of phenomena. That's the first stage. When the action ceases, it imprints a potency or predisposition into the consciousness, and the continuum of the consciousness carries this potency to the time of fruition of that karma. In this way, an action creates both an immediate result and a potential that eventually brings about either a pleasant or painful experience in the future. So your assignment is, please find an example of this pattern in yourself as you study your actions more closely. Name the action, the imprint or predisposition in your consciousness stemming from this action, and if possible, the fruition as a pleasant or painful experience that arose as a result. Try to find two or even three examples of this acting out in your own consciousness so that you really get how karma carries on inside of you. I really want you to understand this thing, that this word has gotten into the vernacular and people just kind of fling it around. They have no idea what they're talking about. And then they sort of go, oh, I don't believe in that anyway. Like, you know, there's no way not to believe in cause and effect. Or just prove it to yourself. If you don't, you know, find something that doesn't have a cause. And that's Buddhism, basically. That's karma. And Buddhism is very steeply based in the understanding of karma. Okay, I'm going to get quiet for a minute to give you a chance to think about if you have a question. Well, I better not wait too long. Do you have any questions?
Yes, Kale. The first one that we have is, can you give us an example of how the Dalai Lama is saying that karma works inside us, both as creating a result and a potential for a future experience?
I think that a really good example is some of our habits that we can't overcome, like drinking. You know, people, I hear so often, you know, I went to this party and I was swore I was only going to have one drink, and then I had the drink, and then I had another drink, and then then they go home and next day they have a hangover. That's an example of an action that had an effect, a result right away. You become inebriated to some extent, and then there's a potency or a disposition to repeat that action. I think there's a lot of that in overeating. There's a lot of that. You start and then it's delicious and it's really hard to stop. Even if you're full, it's hard to stop. And then furthermore, there's almost immediately a desire to do it again. So not in everybody, but that's another example. And I think stealing is another example of you somehow succeed to get that thing you want, and then you realize, oh, that wasn't hard, that was easy. I'm gonna do that again. And then, you know, you do that until you're caught. And then even when you're caught, there's still the disposition. So I think that probably answers your question. That's kind of how it goes. It's really hard. I think it's really hard. For me, I didn't realize that when we have an action, automatically it's in two parts, the result and then the predisposition for another repetition. I didn't know that before I studied this. So, and it really is, wow. We just really have to be careful with our actions. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So the next one that we got is, so somebody said, this is more a comment than a question. But when the Dalai Lama said, attitudes of desire and hatred are all based on an exaggerated sense of I, are they not? I thought, yes. Both as individuals with our exaggerated sense of I and as human beings as a collective. We human beings position ourselves in relation to almost everything else as better and more important to the point where we are destroying the planet. If we're all doing this unconsciously as individuals, no wonder we're making this kind of impact as a group. In fact, it seems inevitable. I've never thought of it like this before.
I know. I'm reading a book right now called Braiding, B-R-A-I-D-I-N-G, like Braiding Sweetgrass. And I can't remember the name of the indigenous Indian woman, ecologist, and her field is she has a PhD in botany. And she's writing about different experiences of her connection, her inherent connection with the earth and all the beings connected with the earth, and how the Indian people, how their understanding is so much deeper than most of ours, and how they give back. They have this very generous, you know, if they live near a forest, they'll make a beautiful statue out of the wood, and then they'll bring that statue to the forest and make an offering it to the forest gods. And we don't think about forest gods, we being, you know, our general community of human beings. Anyway, I don't have anything to add to your statement, and it's certainly true that we're slowly but surely destroying the planet as we experience every day with our weather. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Gail. So the next one that we just got is, I'm going to have a hard time disclosing some of my ill deeds. Should I believe I have to reveal to another person and not just to myself?
Yes, the other is very important. However, it can be a statue or a picture or anything that you've imbued, any like sacred object that you've imbued with the presence of either God, if that's what your belief system, or any kind of a great teacher. So any greater being, an image of any kind, you can confess to that being, and you can do it in any way. You can make an offering, you can just pray to that person or being or presence, and it's the sincerity of the feeling in your heart of, I'm so sorry that I did whatever it is. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. Like that contrition. And you can actually feel lighter after, you can feel the karma lighten. And you can repeat that too. You can do it more than once. So if you don't have someone, you know, like a priest or a minister or the head of your spiritual community, or your teacher or something like that, then you can do it just inside yourself. As you invoke the presence of a greater being. Thank you. That was a really good question. And I see that I better stop now. I really thank you for bearing with this somewhat dense material. And I know the chart looks really confusing, but it's actually going to get less dense pretty soon. Probably not quite next week, but soon it's going to, and then it'll get so that it's just common sense and you'll be able to feel everything right inside yourself. But that's why I'm encouraging you to really make an effort to get started at this harder part, like the transition between ignorance and action, just to really, really try to get a feel for what the Dalai Lama was talking about. It'll get way easier later. All right. So I do thank you all for staying with it. And I thank the people who come during the week to listen, and to my team, Brian and Brendan and Sahar, who work very hard behind the scenes to make these talks possible and to make it possible for you to have them on the website so you can listen whenever you have the chance. Thank you so much. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.